I'm Bill Edwards. I'm going to use this thing to point with as much as possible because I like the novelty of it. This talk is about some work I did as a PhD student at Oxford University Computing Laboratory and subsequently as a postdoc. It began as some joint work with my supervisor, PhD supervisor Bob Kuka, and it sort of grew out of some conversations and work we did with Rob Speckings here when he came to visit a few years ago now to Oxford. It began with an attempt to express the toy bit theory due to Rob in terms of the symmetric monoidal categorical framework developed by Bob and his collaborator, my other supervisor, Samson Abramsky. Probably most people here are familiar with Rob's toy theory, so I should say a little bit about the categorical framework developed by Samson and Bob. What can I say about that? Well, to begin with, I should say what a category is. A category is, it's a big complicated subject, category theory, but fortunately we really only need to scratch the surface. A category is a kind of algebraic object, like a group or a vector space or something like that. And a category has two types of element. These are called objects and arrows. The objects really are just labels which tell you which arrows can be combined with one another. And it's really the arrows where the algebraic structure resides. So, for example, I can have an arrow which begins on object A, ends on object B, and I can combine that or compose it with any other arrow that begins on B. So, for example, G begins on B, goes to C, and if I compose F with G, I wind up with a third arrow, let's say H, going from A to C. So, I guess fairly trivially, any physical theory has got an associated category with it, which I'm going to call the process category. And that comes about by sort of imagining that every system in the theory is an object, and all the processes which the systems can undergo are represented by arrows. For example, here, F is, if this is viewed as a sort of the process category of a physical theory, F is a type of process which takes a system of type A and turns it into a system of type B. We can also, in categories, have arrows that begin and end on the same object. So these are processes which don't change the type of the system that we've got. How is it useful to look at the process category of a physical theory? Well, it allows comparison of theories which in their normal form are formulated in quite different mathematical terms. The example that we're going to look at, Rob Speckens' toy bit theory is intended to come close to sort of mimicking a qubit, but the way that the theory is actually expressed has got nothing to do with Hilbert spaces or linear maps. It uses really subsets of a sort of set of states and relations between those sets. By looking at the process categories of the two theories, we can compare them on a more sort of equal footing. We can see that they actually look quite similar when we look at the categories. We can sort of pinpoint some of the differences between the theories. And I suppose the hope is that by comparing theories in this fashion, we can sort of say which mathematical features of the categories correspond with which physical features of the theory. The sort of test case that we're going to be interested here is to compare two theories, a fragment of quantum mechanics for the qubit stabilizer theory and also Rob's toy bit theory. And in particular, the physical sort of feature of the theories that we're going to be interested in is the possibility of a local hidden variable interpretation, which is clearly possible in this case, as we'll see, and not possible in that case. So, So this is roughly how the talk's going to go. I'm going to begin by telling you about loads of stuff you probably know about already, almost certainly. Then I'll get onto this stuff. I'll give a quick sort of summary of this categorical framework and introduce the process categories of the two theories that we're going to be looking at, STAB, the stabilizer theories category, and SPEC, the toy theories category. Bob Cooker came up with this name for the category. I think he named it after Rob, but it means something in Flemish, which is Bob's native language. I'm not sure what it means, but it caused him endless amusement. He told you it meant bacon. I don't know actually for sure what it means. We're going to identify some key structures which arise in both of these categories, which to some extent can be said to account for their similarities, and also note where some of these subtly differ. And then we're going to relate this difference, a difference in one of these structures, a group which arises naturally in a categorical formulation called the phase group. I'm going to relate that to the issue of local hidden variables. So I'll begin by talking very quickly about hidden variables, stuff that probably everyone knows about, but it's worth just recapping a couple of things. So does quantum mechanics have an underlying hidden variable interpretation? Well, quantum states give us the probabilities of different outcomes. Do these probabilities reflect an epistemic probability distribution over a set of hidden states, each of which has a definite value for each observable? We know the answer to that is no. There are various sort of theorems that tell us that that's not possible. But for the purposes of this talk, we're going to be interested in one particular theorem, no-go theorem of this sort. I think it's probably one of the most sort of elegant and simple sort of demonstrations that you can't have a local hidden variable interpretation of quantum mechanics. This is the argument involving the GHZ state, and I believe this the argument in this form is due to David Merman. What we have is three qubits, 1, 2, and 3 over here, and we prepare them to begin with in the GHZ state, and then we separate them. And the argument sort of says, well, if there is a hidden variable interpretation, then, well, we're going to concentrate particularly on two variables, two observables, the X and the Y Pauli operators, each of which can have a value either of +1 or -1. And if there really is a hidden variable interpretation, then there should be definite values for each of these six observables, either +1 or -1, in any particular run of the experiment. So, is this compatible with what the predictions of quantum mechanics tell us? Well, we begin by noting that the GHZ state is an eigenstate of four different operators. This one, it's a +1 eigenstate of this, I think. Was it a minus? +1. It's a -1, it's an eigenstate of each of these operators, and on the right, I'm writing the eigenvalue associated with the eigenstate. Okay. So, if we sort of write these down in a table across like this, each row of the table sort of represents a run of the experiment, a possible set of observables we could measure. And we know from the fact that the GHZ state is an eigenstate of these operators with these eigenvalues that whatever values we plug in here, we could get 1, -1 for any of these. But when we multiply all three together, the outcome will be 1. And likewise for the other rows, when we multiply the values together, the answers will be -1. So if there is a hidden variable interpretation, then what we should be able to do is write in a value of 1 and -1 for each of these. And we should be able to do that in a way which respects these sort of parities of these rows. So this isn't possible. Why is that? Well, we do have to make one assumption. We look here, this, X1, where it appears here, we fill in either a 1 or a minus 1 there, and we sort of assume that, well, we should fill in the same number for the x1, this disappearance of x1 here, reason being that it shouldn't matter if we believe in locality that we chose to measure x for the second and third particles, or y. That shouldn't make any difference to the value. So in that case, that value appears twice in this column, whether it's 1 or minus 1. When we multiply all the numbers in the column together, we must get 1 for each column. And then if we imagine trying to multiply all the numbers in the table together, well, if we begin by multiplying rows and then multiply these together, we get minus 1 for the whole table. If we begin by multiplying columns, and we've got 1 at the bottom here, and that tells us that the sort of total product for the whole table should be 1, so that's a contradiction. And so it's impossible to model the GHZ state with a local hidden variable interpretation. Okay, right. I'm going to run quickly now through Rob's toy bit theory. This is probably, again, something that everybody here knows. Personally, though, with talks, certainly as an audience member for talks, I prefer the talks where I know almost all of it to begin with, because talks like that make me feel intelligent rather than stupid. So I've tried to sort of keep to that principle when giving talks myself. So, Rob Speckens' toy bit theory. As I understand it, and I have to be more careful when giving the talk when the man himself is present, but as I understand it, the motivation for this was showing that many of the characteristic features of quantum theory can be explained not by any particular details of the ontology of what's going on, but just simply the fact that we've got our knowledge of what's going on is restricted in some sense. Is that fair? Yeah, good. So this particular theory, you've got a single type of system that appears in the theory, and it can exist in one of four ontic states. They're called ontic states because this is actually the state of the system, apparently. It's either in state 1, 2, 3, and 4. And that's the real existing state of affairs. But the thing is, we can't actually know for sure which ontic state it's in. Now, basically, all of the mileage out of this sort of work comes from a particular restriction on our knowledge of the ontic state, something called the knowledge balance principle. And it's a little bit awkward to state, so I won't go into details here. I'll just case by case tell you sort of what the outcome of this, of applying this principle is to each case. If we look at a single system, then basically what the knowledge balance principle tells us is we can at best know that the system is what is in one of two ontic states. So as you can see, there are sort of six states of maximal knowledge. And Rob calls these epistemic states, and it's epistemic states which are intended to be like the analog of the quantum state. You can see that epistemic states are described by subsets of this set of states. Measurements in the theory. A measurement basically consists of asking as many yes-no questions as possible while still respecting this knowledge balance principle. So for a single system, there's three types of measurements you can make. You can say, is it in ontic state 1 or 2, or is it in ontic state 3 or 4, and so on. There's three possible measurements we can make. It turns out, in order to ensure that the knowledge balance principle is respected after the measurement, each measurement needs to induce an inevitable sort of disturbance of the ontic state. And what this basically means is that this sort of disturbance is best described, its effect on the epistemic state is best described as a relation on the set of ontic states. Relation as opposed, say, to a function. The analysis can be extended to compound systems. So, for example, this is the state space of a pair of systems. It's just like the Cartesian product of the state spaces of two single systems. And it turns out that if you respect this knowledge balance principle, there's two types of state that you can have. You can have this sort of uncorrelated thing that's analogous to a separable quantum state, and you can have this maximally correlated thing, which is analogous to a maximally entangled state. So the toy theory exhibits many characteristically quantum features, For example, there are incompatible observables, no cloning theorem applies, quantum information processing protocols such as teleportation, dense coding, but it is by construction a local hidden variable theory. Maybe I didn't make that completely clear, but it's clear in the paper where the theory's laid out that when you make a measurement, the disturbance that occurs doesn't influence the other party. If you're making a measurement on a compound system, then the measurement you make on one part of that can't cause any disturbance to the other part, to the other subsystem. So we've got a local theory there, and it's clearly a hidden variable theory. I said it comes close to replicating quantum mechanics. I suppose that's more correctly, it comes close to mimicking, well, it mimics a fragment of quantum mechanics. That's the qubit stabilizer theory, which is a closed sub-theory of quantum mechanics. Here, the only type of system we've got are qubits, and they are restricted to be in the stabilizer state, the definition of which I can't quite remember. I think they're eigenstates of tensor products of Pauli operators. The processes they can undergo are a subset of the unitary operations, they're the Clifford operations, and the only observables we've got are the Pauli operators and tensor products of them. Single qubit states, we've just got six. They're the eigenstates of each of the three Pauli operators. Two qubit states, we get 36 product states and 24 maximally entangled states. They're the same numbers that we get. We get 36 of these in the toy theory and 24 of them. So they look very similar. Three qubit states, we get a whole bunch more states, including, importantly, the GHZ state. So the qubit stabilizer theory looks... Yes?
Pauli operators as the observables. Yeah. You mean in some fixed basis you only have the sigma x, sigma y, and sigma z in that basis? Some is that what you mean?
Fixed basis, I don't fully... You've got three...
But do I have the sigma x plus sigma y over the square root of 2, is that...
In a spatial basis, you just have those three.
The qubit stabilizer theory and the toy bit theory have a lot of features in common. They have the same numbers of states. The states are all quite similar. Many features in common. However, the qubit stabilizer theory differs physically from the toy theory because it cannot have a local hidden variable interpretation. That's kind of clear if you think about the Mermin argument that I gave you earlier, because all of the essential ingredients of this argument still survive in the stabilizer theory. The GHZ state is still there, we've still got qubits, and we can still do these measurements here. Okay, how are we doing? All right. Okay. So now I should talk about a little bit about the categorical approach. In quantum mechanics, states are described by vectors, processes by linear maps. In the toy bit theory, states are described by subsets, and processes are described by relations. But we're not going to be really interested in these details. We're going to confine our attention to sort of the algebra of how the processes in the theories combine. So this sort of approach, I think, was begun by Samson and Bob, my two supervisors. They were interested in looking at the category, the sort of process category of full quantum mechanics or finite dimensional quantum mechanics, which is called F-Hilbe. And they were interested in sort of looking at what features of that category corresponded to different physical features of quantum mechanics. We don't actually have to go into too much detail about categories. Instead, I want to sort of talk about or introduce a kind of a graphical language for reasoning about process categories. So in this language, I just get rid of that. All right, we'll leave that one. That one's gone, I think. Doesn't matter anyway. Early I drew an arrow F going from an object A to an object B. And now in this sort of new notation, I want to depict an arrow going from A to B as this sort of box, and the A objects A and B as being wires that enter and leave the box. Now, I think this sort of, if we're thinking about sort of process categories, the categories associated with theories, I think this brings, is quite a good depiction of this, because we sort of imagine this system A coming into the box, undergoing some kind of process in the box, and popping out again, changed into a system of type B. If we want to compose two systems, we just sort of put the boxes one after another like that, and that's equal, we'll say, to another type of system, another type of process H. Yeah.
Don't need that.
Okay, the transformations. We probably don't need to talk about that too much, what I'm going to say. Basically, they are they're a subset of the relations that you can, what's the best way to put this? So each system is described by either this set of four states or tensor or Cartesian products of that. And the relations and the operations are either functions or relations between these sets. They're not just any relation or any function, but it's not really important for what I'm going to say exactly what they are.
Okay. I understand function. I'm not sure I understand relation.
Okay.
So you say it's not important.
Well, relation, what I mean by relation, I guess that is important. So by relation, I just mean. Is that ball
broken? Yeah, there's another one.
Or is it the right-hand side?
Okay. So, a relation is just like a more generalized version of a function in that if I go from the domain, not every element in the domain has to map to something. And elements of the domain can map to multiple points in the codomain.
So suppose that happens, how do you interpret that? That one of them happens, you just don't know which one?
Yeah, and this sort of, the reason it arises in this toy theory is because you get a sort of probabilistic, or it's not really probabilistic, probabilities aren't assigned, but an indeterminate transformation of the ontic state into either, suppose you've discovered the ontic state is one, then it gets transformed into either one or two. And if you're looking, if the states that you're interested in transforming are the epistemic states, which are subsets of the state space, then this is the best way to describe what happens there. Okay. Right. So, diagrams representing processes in the fingers, that's right, okay. So, here's the composition of two processes, and depending on what category we're talking about, that tells which category we're in, sort of gives us the algebra of which processes, when we combine these two processes, do we get process H, for example, as opposed, say, to process K or something. We'll also... in general, these process categories associated with physical theories are a type of category called a symmetric monoidal category. And what that basically means is that you can combine two objects into like a third object. And what this sort of corresponds to physically is the fact that we can take two physical systems, group them together, and view them as one composite system. So this is how we're going to depict this in the sort of diagrammatic notation. Now, in the particular category, in the particular concrete case of quantum mechanics, what we're using there is the tensor product. In the toy theory, we use the Cartesian product to bring together two systems to make a composite. But this is really important. What we're interested in is really those sort of differences get abstracted away. What we're interested in is really the things we can prove using these diagrams.
Here's a process involving interaction, whereas in this case here, this is how we've depicted sort of two parallel processes taking place. In a symmetric monoidal category, you have a particular type of object, the unit object, which in the physical interpretation we would sort of interpret as no system. And diagrams like this sort of represent morphisms going from this unit object into another object A. Physically, we sort of think about them as preparation of a new state. I suppose if you don't want to think of a system just coming out of nothing, you could imagine this as being part of this sort of operation, which sort of depicts system A coming in, and system A comes out, but there's no, the original state of system A has no bearing on its state now after it's come out from this operation. When we take instead this sort of combination like this, that's something we call a scalar. In quantum mechanics, the particular concrete case of quantum mechanics, these scalars are the complex numbers. In the toy theory, they are the Boolean 0 and 1. Okay, so the categories we're interested in are F-Hilbe. The category associated with full quantum mechanics is F-Hilbe, which is already quite well known to mathematicians. That's the category whose objects are finite dimensional Hilbert spaces and whose arrows are linear maps. The process category associated with the stabilizer theory we're calling STAB. The one associated with Rob's toy bit theory we're calling SPEC. We won't go into the structure in detail, but what I will now talk about is some of the categorical features which these categories have in common. What I've just described would be features in common to any process category. So these are features which would be more particular to categories, to theories that are in some sense quantum-like. So one of the first things is, in any of these categories, we have a bijection between arrows from object A to B and arrows from object B to A. In quantum mechanics and the stabilizer theory, this corresponds to taking the adjoint of the linear map. In the toy theory, this corresponds to the relational converse. This isn't a general property of any category. For example, if we have the category set, whose objects are sets and whose arrows are functions between the sets, there's no way in general to form a bijection between functions from A to B and functions from B to A. It's sort of simple to think about that. If you imagine that A is a much larger set than B, then obviously there are far more functions going from A than there are to B going from, than there are functions going from B to A. With relations, though, because of how I just described relations can be, with the possibility of mapping into multiple elements of the codomain, then you can just make a bijection between these two ideas. Okay. We would like some kind of, well, we'll need some kind of arrow which represents something like an impossible process. For example, we might, in our theory, have two processes which actually in practice never occur subsequently, like the probability of one process occurring, given that the first one has occurred, might be zero, for example. So we would expect something like a zero process to appear in the category. That's because, given that the category is a sort of a closed algebraic system, we want to be able to compose any two morphisms within it, even if physically that never happens. So we need to assign that composition to some value, to some arrow in the category. So if we have this, for every pair of objects, we have this sort of process or arrow, the zero arrow, and it's not hard to sort of see that any kind of zero arrow should have these sort of properties. If you combine it with anything else, it should go to being the zero arrow. In particular, we have zero scalars. So I just described the scalar earlier as being something with sort of no input and no output. So we have a zero scalar as well. a system or an object A has a compact structure if I should have introduced some terminology earlier. Oh no, it's going completely the wrong way. An arrow or morphism of this type I'm going to call a state of system A, because what we're really doing here is we're preparing system A in a particular state. So if an object has a state of this form, here physically we interpret that as the preparation of a pair of systems of type A in some state and a sort of a co-state. And if they combine together according to this equality, then we say that there's a compact structure on that object. And it turns out that quantum mechanically, every system, so every object in the process category, has such a state and a co-state. And in fact, what they are is the Bell state, or the sort of generalized Bell state on that object. Incidentally, this sort of diagram, I suppose, can be sort of viewed as describing teleportation using Bell state. If I feed in any old category, any old state here, and I've prepared a Bell state here, and then I make it's sort of post-selected this, I make a Bell measurement here, then the effect is that the state winds up over here, if that makes sense. If it doesn't, don't worry, because it's not important to what comes. There should be, yeah, that's my mistake. For our purposes, just mathematically, one of the important things about if every object in a category has this structure, then we call it a compact closed category. If we've got that, then one of the consequences of that is that for every arrow within the category, we have bijections between like an arrow of that type with an A and a B input and a C output, and other types of process. For example, here we've got A, B, and C input. Over here we've got an A input and a B and a C output. Okay? And it's straightforward to see from this equality here that we can sort of make a bijection here. We can, if we add another one on the end of that, then we get back to where we started. Okay. Some of these bijections are of particular importance to us. For example, if we've got to begin with a process that starts with a system A, ends on a system B, and then we add, we sort of flip around the input and the output, and we wind up with a process going from B to A, we call that F upper star. In the concrete case of quantum mechanics, that corresponds to transposing the matrix, which represents the process F. In the toy theory, that corresponds to relational converse.
Are you selecting other distinguished bases for each?
Yeah, you do, because in fact there are multiple possible compact structures associated with each, one for each orthonormal basis, right. Basically. We can also, if we did the same thing you remember a few slides ago I mentioned the dagger operation, which is another form of bijection between morphisms. If we do the upper star bijection to the dagger, then we wind up with something called the lower star. And we will mention this again later. In quantum mechanics, this corresponds to complex conjugation of the operation.
And in the toy theory, it's actually it has no effect on the relation which represents the operation. Yep.
You're removing certain kinds of...
How do you mean?
You're removing... Well, because you've sort of provided each system with a distinguished basis, which in the normal presentation is not there. So I'm just wondering what that means physically.
I I don't mean to single out any basis in particular. Really, there should be an upper star and a lower star operation for every basis, I suppose.
So you're saying there's, this is not really part of the structure of the category,
is
it?
This is not.
Is that part of the structure of the category? It allows, I mean, it's for each Hilbert space, is in each choice of basis?
Yeah.
For each Hilbert space, is there a different, for each system, it has its own Hilbert space?
Yeah.
As we normally think about it?
Yeah.
Are you choosing independently a basis for each system and then calling that one category, and then you have another one which...
Okay, well, the same category could exhibit many of these compact structures.
Oh, so that's just a structure that you could add to the category.
It's present there, really. I mean, I'm saying that a category is a compact closed category if every object has at least one of these compact structures. In fact, in the case of Hill, there'll be many.
So it just has to admit such a complex.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not picking out one and saying,
no.
This one is the physically right one.
No, that'll probably become a bit later. Okay, so
probably the most important definition that I'll come to is something called a basis structure. And this again appears in both the categories STAB and SPEC, the process categories of our theories of interest. So it's got quite a suggestive name, but initially I'll just sort of introduce it in abstract terms. So a basis structure on an object in a category consists of a pair of arrows. You've got this arrow delta, which goes from an object A into two copies of the object A, and epsilon, which sort of gets rid of the object A, maps it into the identity object, which physically we're interpreting as being no system. So to be a basis structure, these morphisms have to satisfy the following conditions. So these are sort of categorical equations. These are all to do with how the equating different sort of compositions of these processes. So these aren't actually incredibly enlightening to look at, but I think they're quite aesthetically appealing. That's just me. Okay, so obviously, having called it a basis structure, you'd expect it to have something to do with bases. And in fact, the name came about because in quantum mechanics, in the categories F. Hilb and in the category STAB, there's a bijective correspondence between basis structures and orthonormal bases. And how does that work explicitly? Remember, in a basis structure, you've got two types of arrow or process, epsilon and delta.
Associativity, because associativity would, you have a notion of flow from left to right.
It's co-associativity because you're going from sort of left to right. You could imagine
that would be associativity.
Associativity would be from right to left. Because associativity normally applies to a binary operation, right? With two inputs, it gives you an output. This here would be correspond to associativity of a binary operation. Yeah, and likewise, this is sort of like the unit of the binary operation.
How does this structure that you're describing relate to operands, the theory of operands?
Absolutely no idea.
I'm sorry. That's right.
I've heard the word, though, from someone who I do work with, so maybe there is some connection, but I'm not a man to ask.
Looks like it's a dual pitch.
Okay, so explicitly, if our object is a Hilbert space, category Hilb, then delta, and it's got an orthonormal basis I,
then delta is a map which copies each basis vector, and epsilon is the one which maps them all into the number one. So, for example, the qubit in the stabilizer theory, the object representing a single qubit in the category corresponding to the stabilizer theory has three basis structures. Delta Z, which I'm going to say copies X, copies 0 and 1, the Pauli Z eigenstates X and Y. Basis structures appear in the toy theory as well. Maybe not quite so instructive to look at. This is an example of a relation between where's the chalk? So this is going, this is a relation which relates the four element state space of, or set of states of a single system, and relates it to the 16 element set of states of a pair of systems. And so this is a good demonstration of a relation. This relates state one to a pair of states here, 1, 1 and 2, 2. So the relation sort of goes from here and to here. And then the state two is then mapped into 1, 2 and 2, 1 and so on. What an enlightening diagram. It may not be completely obvious, but basically delta copies the following two epistemic states. So if we feed in those states into this delta operator, this delta, this relation delta, then we basically wind up with a pair of those states. And it turns out that on the object representing the single system in the category spec, that's the toy theory category, we have, again, three basis structures. And they copy, one of them copies these two. And if we go back to the epistemic states that appear in toy theory, one of them copies these two, one of them copies these two, one of them copies these two. So, guys, unbelievable how your talk just expands to fill the time available, isn't it? I'm sure I gave this in like half an hour once, and bloody hell. Okay, so I want to make an abstract definition here, sort of inspired by the concrete cases. So here's a basis structure in an abstract category or category we're not specifying, and we're feeding in a state, and we get out two copies of the same state. And we're going to call those the eigenstates corresponding to this basis structure. I'm not sure if that's a great choice of terminology, but I'll stick with it because it appears all the way through the slides. So these are sort of the copied states. So concretely, these, for example, are going to be the eigenstates for this basis structure. These are the eigenstates for this particular basis structure. You should get some idea of why I use the terminology. I mentioned before that in compact closed categories and categories with the Bagger functor, we've got various bijections between different types of process. See, these sort of bijections come about through like bending wires around. That's the way they can be seen graphically. So given the delta and epsilon morphisms that are appear in a basis structure, we can sort of bend around some of the input and output wires to get different morphisms, which are important for what we're going to do. Now, it turns out, well, if we bend around the input line to make it an output line, we then have a process which corresponds to the preparation of a tripartite state. And in the concrete case of quantum mechanics, if we begin with the delta, which copies the 0 and 1 basis, then we wind up with the GHZ state. Well, the unnormalized GHZ state seen there. If we started with one of the basis structures from Rob's theory and we bend the wire around, then we actually end up with the tripartite state, which is sort of as analogous to the GHZ state as the toy theory gets. If, in contrast, I bent round one of the output wires to become an input wire, so I've now got something with two inputs and one output, then this is also quite interesting. This comes back to a question I had earlier about associativity. Here we've got something, if we imagine plugging in two states on the object A, then we wind up with a third state on the object A. And it turns out from the axioms defining a basis structure, these, we can show that this sort of binary operational state is a commutative monoid. Now, concretely, what is this in quantum mechanics, for example? Remember that we're dealing with a particular basis structure here, and this corresponds to a particular orthonormal basis on the object. So if we express our two states, psi and phi, in terms of that basis, we write them out, here they're coefficients in terms of the basis, then it turns out that this monoidal product is given by multiplying the coefficients together. Obviously, this is a very basis-dependent definition, but that's to be expected because we've used a particular basis structure to define it. If we recall that the sort of abstract, this lower star operation that I defined here, we can apply this to states as well. And remembering that this corresponds to complex conjugation, we can see that this product here, well, so long as psi is unbiased with respect to the basis that we're dealing with, then this product here is basically up to normalization, gives us this vector here. And abstractly, we can write that in this form here. So taking the lead from the concrete case, we then say in the general categorical setting, a state psi is unbiased with respect to a basis structure if this diagram holds. Now, this thing here, this operation here with two inputs, we saw acted as a monoid on any pair of states that we inputted in. And if we restrict ourselves to the unbiased states, then we in fact find that they form a closed subgroup of the monoid, which we call the phase group. And this is the identity and of the monoid. And so we can see that this lower star operation corresponds to the inverse of the subgroup, the phase group. So just to recap, we've sort of looked at a whole bunch of structures which occur in the categories STAB and SPEC. In particular, these basis structures have been important. And if we look now, if we consider the category, the object in STAB, which represents a single qubit, and the object in SPEC, which represents a single elementary system of the toy theory, then each of these has three basis structures. They each have two eigenstates, or copied states, and each of these basis structures has four unbiased states, it turns out. The unbiased states, remember, form a closed subgroup under the action of the monoid. And so in each case, this subgroup must be a four-element group. I should have mentioned earlier that because the monoid is commutative, this needs to be an abelian group. And there are only two four-element abelian groups. So up to this point, the category STAB and SPEC have both featured, you know, a large number of similar mathematical structures, but this is one key difference between them, that in the case of STAB, the phase group is the cyclic group Z4, and in the case of SPEC, the phase group is this direct product Z2 times Z2. Okay, all of this would be of limited interest if there was no sort of connection with the physical features of the theory. However, we do observe that in both quantum mechanics and the toy theory, we observe the following correspondence, which we've sort of seen already, that observables that we measure in the theory correspond to basis structures. And furthermore, that the outcomes of these measurements correspond to the eigenstates of these basis structures, that is, the copied states. If we go back, this basis structure here corresponds to a measurement of the Z Pauli observable, and here are the outcomes of that measurement. Similarly, for example, this corresponds to a particular measurement in the toy theory, and here are the two possible outcomes. Furthermore, if we look concretely, do concrete calculations within the theories, we find that If we prepare a system of state psi, the probability of obtaining a measurement outcome corresponding to an eigenstate xi for the corresponding base structure is some function of this scalar, where which we write out in a sort of abstract graphical language. Specifically, we're interested in the cases when the scalar is equal to the zero scalar. In those cases, the probability is zero, i.e. that this is not a possible outcome for this. If we try and make a measurement of that observable on this state psi, then that is not a possible outcome for the measurement. We're going to be particularly interested when the state that we've prepared is one of these abstract GHZ states. Concretely, in quantum mechanics, that means a GHZ state. More generally, it means one of these states here, which we got by bending around an input wire of the delta morphism. Here, A, B, and C represent outcomes of measurement, and so each of them is the eigenstate of some basis structure. This is a point where everyone gets massively confused, including sometimes me. This GHZ state derives from some basis structure. These A, B, and C are eigenstates of some basis structures. They don't have to be the same one. For example, the GHZ state could derive, if we were in quantum mechanics, from this basis structure here, in which case it would be the 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1 state. And the A and B, for example, could be eigenstates of the X basis structure, and the C could be an eigenstate of the C of the Y basis structure. When we have this equal to a zero scalar, then we say that this triple of outcomes is a forbidden triple with respect to this basis structure, or this GHZ state. So concretely, we know in both the theories we're looking at that if we take two eigenstates of the same basis structure and sort of combine them together in this sort of scalar, we get the zero scalar. Obviously, if you take the inner product of two orthogonal vectors, you get zero, and it's the same that happens in the toy theory. This slide is just sort of saying that under certain reasonable assumptions for the process categories of other theories, we can expect this to be the same as well. Right, this is the slide which really confuses everybody. Okay. This is the GHZ state, the abstract GHZ state arising from some basis structure. This is the monoid that we get from this basis structure as well, the monoid on the states. Well, let's just work through the graphical equations to begin with. We've plugged off two outputs with A and B, which correspond to outcomes of a measurement and so are eigenstates of some basis structure. What we do then is bend the output wires around, and part of the rules of how to manipulate the diagrams, which I haven't gone into in great detail, say that when you bend the wires around, we pick up lower stars. Remember that if these are unbiased states with respect to this basis structure, then they're elements of the phase group, and the lower star is the inverse with respect to that group structure. So overall, we can say that this product here is equal to this state here, A times B, using the monoidal multiplication, all lower stars. So suppose that A times B, lower star, is the eigenstate of some basis structure, and C is an eigenstate of the same basis structure, but not the same eigenstate. If we take this product, it's equal to the zero scalar. So what that means is that this set of outcomes is a forbidden triple of outcomes. Okay, we'll come back to that and it should become a bit clearer. Just want to do a quick bit of notation here. I'm going to run through an argument that should apply both to the spec case and the stab case. I want to sort of be able to do it in one go. So I'd like to be able to give a sort of consistent labeling for both of them. Z0 is going to be refer to this state when I'm talking about stab and this state when I'm talking about spec. And you can see that I've grouped together eigenstates of the same basis structure in each case. So let's think about the basis structure which copies this and this in the case of stab and this in the case of spec. We saw that that basis structure had these four states as unbiased states. Therefore, these will constitute the elements of this phase group, which is the closed subgroup of the monoid. So we can write out the phase group tables. This is the phase group for spec, which, as I said, was Z2 times Z2. And this is the phase group for stab, which is the cyclic group Z4. You can see that they only really differ in this bottom right quadrant. It's also worth noting that these two are the eigenstates of the X basis structure, and these form a subgroup of the phase group, and the eigenstates of the Y basis structure are the coset to that subgroup, which means that within each quadrant we get states which are all eigenstates of the same basis structure. Now, I sort of argued before here that that we should expect A, B, and this thing here not to be a forbidden triple, but to be an allowed triple. That means that this phase group table, basically, if you take this and this, then the corresponding entry is the monoidal product of those two. So this table is close to telling us the allowed triples for the GHZ state. What we would need to do to get the allowed triples is to take the inverse of each entry in the table. That's because these are examples of allowed triples. So if I now move from the phase group table to the allowed triple table, basically by taking the inverse of every element within the table. So now, for example, if I take X1, X1, and X0, that is an allowed set of outcomes when I make a measurement of X, X, X on the GHZ state. Okay. Notice that because of the subgroup and coset structure, basically each quadrant of the table tells us about a particular triple of observables. This quadrant tells us about allowed triples if we measure X, X, X. This one tells us about allowed triples of outcomes if we measure X, Y, Y, and so on. Okay. Going back to this argument here, which says that if C is another eigenstate of the same basis structure that this is an eigenstate of, then ABC is a forbidden triple. What that means for us in this case is that any triple that you can't read off from this table is a forbidden outcome, has zero probability of occurring. So what this tells us is this: the phase group table basically tells us for these four observables, it tells us all the allowed outcomes, and anything that doesn't appear in this table is forbidden or zero probability. So these triples of observables should look familiar, right? They are the ones that we appeared in the Mermin no-go argument that I introduced at the start. And as from the sort of abstract setting we're in, what would it mean to have a hidden variable interpretation? It would mean that we could definitely assign a particular outcome, X0 or X1, to every observable in this table, for example, like that. So is that allowed? So you can see from the table that if we look at the labels on each outcome, for example, if we take this triple here and we add the labels modulo 2, yeah, then we get 0 in each case, right? X0, X1, and X1, for example. And for the spec parities, we get 0 for each quadrant, whereas for the stab parities, we get 1, 1, and 1. So this difference derives basically exactly from the fact that the phase groups differ in each case. It also is what allows us to make a no-go proof, basically, for stab. Basically, I'm just giving you pretty much the proof that I gave you at the start, the Merman proof. And it's what won't allow the same sort of argument to occur in the case for spec, which is what we should expect, because the accompanying theory, the toy theory, is a local hidden variable theory, so we shouldn't be able to make an argument against it. The origin of this difference regarding locality, well, locality is maybe the wrong word, regarding the possibility of local hidden variables, lies in the difference between the phase group tables. I guess at this stage you could have the uncomfortable feeling I've just told you something that you all knew in a vastly more complicated fashion than was required before. But I guess the point of all this is that is to point out, from the categorical point of view, if we look at the process category accompanying a theory, then this phase group should be able to tell us something immediately about that theory regarding whether or not it has a local hidden variable interpretation. It's also possible to extend this sort of analysis to more general groups. At the moment, I just talked about Z2 times Z2 and Z4, but it's possible to generalize the sort of the Merman argument. Have I got time to mention that? 2 minutes. Suppose I have a theory with some basis structure, and this basis structure has, 12 unbiased states. So its phase group has got 12 elements. The way this needs to work is that we can take these 12 elements and suppose three of them are the eigenstates of some other basis structure. Three of them are the eigenstates of another basis structure, and so on and so on. And these form a subgroup, and these form the coset. That won't happen in all cases, but it does seem to happen in a number of interesting cases. For example, if you generalize to trips, or to, what is the word for when you go to four? Quits? I don't know. Basically, what you have to do is, if you've got a group and you've got a subgroup, then you can take the quotient group of that subgroup. Basically, what the quotient group tells you, it turns out, is which triples of observables you should write into your generalized Merman table. So, for example, for trits, the analogous argument to the Merman argument has 9 rows in it as opposed to 4. The subgroup, the elements of the subgroup turn out to be the parities which label the rows. So we use 0 and 1 in this case. 0 and 1 added modulo 2 are basically the elements of the group Z2, right? And it's Z2 here, which is the subgroup. And whether or not the Merman argument works comes down to, seems to connect to this issue of the group extension problem. The group extension problem is given two groups, G1 and G2, find G such that G1 is a normal subgroup of G and the quotient group is isomorphic to G2. So, for example, that's what we've been looking at as an example of these two cases, right? In both cases, for spec and for stab, our subgroup is G2, the quotient group is G2, But the group extension of these two is different. And that seems to be what determines whether we get whether we can make a Mermin argument against the local hidden variable theory or not. Anyway, that's what I had to say. Thank you.
Questions for Bill?
Yeah. I'm not sure this is a well-formed question entirely, but I was wondering about it. So what you're doing basically, if you're talking in terms of the category, is you take a very simple picture, a few lines and a couple of blocks, and then you kind of say corresponding to that is some structure which I, in my pedestrian way, would describe in a much more complicated way.
Yeah.
And of course, that's the whole appeal of it, I've realised that. But I was wondering if there's a problem of uniqueness associated with that. So, for instance, you take a basic structure and you draw your blobs and lines, and then you say in the toy model that corresponds to this. And I dare say it's a very natural way of defining it.
Yeah.
But could you do it a different way, and would that make a difference?
Do what a different way?
Define the basic structure, what counts as the basic structure in the toy model in a completely different way.
And single out measurements
or whatever, yes. I mean, I was just wondering if this, these particular choices are really forced on you, or whether there's some freedom.
I'm actually not sure the answer to that. For example, I don't know if this is well formed answer to your question. But, in the case of the category Hill, there's a bijective correspondence between basis structures and orthonormal bases. So, it's definitely a correspondence there. Whether there's also a bijective correspondence between orthonormal bases and some other categorical structure, I'm not sure. Is that sort of what you're asking?
Well, I was thinking, so you were taking, I guess that the original motivation, you start with Hilbert space, and then and then you're trying to talk about the toy theory in terms of the same picture. But yeah, I got the impression that when it comes to the toy theory, you're kind of starting with the category, and then you're looking around for what in the toy theory would correspond to those concepts in the category. But I know it's completely misunderstood.
I think it worked out slightly differently to that. I suppose maybe it was the beginning of the whole thing was to note that. Well, how did it begin? The toy theory's category spec is a subcategory of the category rel, whose objects are sets and whose arrows are relations. And that has got quite a lot of things in common with the category F Hilb. And so that had been something that several people in our group had played around with as a sort of a toy model of quantum mechanics. It replicates some of the features. And so we were messing around looking for, we knew that this basis structure had some significance in the Hilbert space case. And when we looked for basis structures in REL, we realized that they basically did seem to correspond to the measurements that you got in the toy theory. So that was, I guess, the beginning. So it wasn't entirely artificial. In fact, that sort of discovery is what sort of.
I wasn't suggesting it was artificial. I was just wondering if there was some freedom.
I'm not sure.
I think it is unique. I mean, isn't it the case that if you ask, which relations satisfy all the axioms you lay down for basis structure, you get, only.
Well,
I think you're asking, could there be more besides the three?
I think he's asking.
And I think the answer is no. You prove that those are the only ones.
I think he was asking if there's another way of realizing the idea of basis as a categorical structure, and that might lead to different, for example, selection of these.
Let's ask, I mean, are you wondering about, okay, we have this one structure inside stabilizer theory or toy theory, and could there be multiple ways of representing it categorically? Or rather, we have this notion of abstract notion of a basis structure in the category, and you wanted to know whether there's multiple ways beyond the ones that you talked about of realizing it within
the second.
The second.
Okay. Second one.
So I think the answer to that question
is definitely in within the category spec, within the category spec, if we take an object and two relations basically of this form, one going from A to A Cartesian product A, and the other going from A into, I think it's a single element set, then which obey these rules, these compositional rules, then the only ones on the object are the ones that I described, if that's the answer to that specific question. More generally, I don't know if there are categorical structures which also equally well embody the notion of basis or whatever. If that's an answer to a different question, I guess. Yes.
Yeah. And so there are many examples that people have thought of similar situations to this geoset. Probably the oldest one is the Kunkel-Schrecker.
Right.
And which comes in Marian variations, and then a very simple one is the one Lucien came up with. And there's even one that I call the three slit experiment, which some people like Webb Weidman call the three box example.
Right. Yeah.
All of these have something in common.
Yeah.
Something it should be possible is impossible. It's impossible if you assume a certain kind of hidden variables.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering if you've applied this same
technology
to any of those other examples.
It's a good question, and yeah, probably should do. The things that you really need to treat at this sort of level of abstraction, it's hard to sort of deal with numbers because, for example, they don't come into the toy theory in any obvious way. So any sort of proofs that you have to do are sort of need to be all or nothing proofs. Like to begin with,
yeah, no, that's the whole point. I didn't mention, for example, the Bell
inequalities. Yeah, wouldn't work. But
which don't fit into this, but the ones I mentioned do fit in. So
I haven't.
For example, the Kunkel-Schrecker, people have different versions of it, but it fits exactly into your setting. It's just a certain number of bases, orthonormal bases, which it have relations among them such that there's no self-consistent solution.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what you have here.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in the original form I read, it was a spin one system, so I think it's a three-dimensional Hilbert space, and you have, I think originally there were 117 different directions you had to look at. It was a large number of triads that you could pick out orthonormal bases within that.
I think
it's been cut down to about 18 or something if you're willing to go to four dimensional numbers.
Yeah,
I forget the exact number. But the point is, there's very many of them, and it seems to me very possible that some of them might
work in the same way.
Might work in the same way.
Yeah,
check out some of your ideas about
it. It'd be interesting to see whether it came again down to this group.
Exactly.
Whether it was different properties in each of these arguments that gave rise to.
Is there some explanation, it turns out, of A's something closer to stab than spec?
Yeah.
Is there something compelling about having the Z4 structure over the Z2 cross Z2?
Don't know.
Okay.
What was the question?
Whether there's something compelling about Z4 versus the Z2 cross.
In relation to stab?
Yeah, in this.
Okay.
Okay. Well, just a different question.
Yeah.
So at the beginning, you said the great thing about this categorical approach is that it allows you to compare different theories in a similar language, and then you put two different theories in it and you compare them in some way. So can you now put your finger on what it is you got in this particular case that you wouldn't have gotten just from noting that Bell's inequalities were violated or whatever. What is that structural thing that you're getting?
I think in any process category in which you can identify the basis structures and so on, you're going to be able to identify phase groups associated with these basis structures. Now, that's not. I've had a few caveats that the extension of Merlin's argument does require phase group to obey a couple of extra conditions. But in general, it should give you a sort of criterion for assessing. Well, it doesn't tell you whether the theory is local or non-local. It tells you if you can form one of these Merlin arguments against it. It can rule out locality, if you like, for a theory. To begin with, I thought, wow, this is brilliant. This is like a sort of criterion for locality. I can start looking at all sorts of different theories in this light. And so one that immediately occurred to me was, well, you have these theories that are more non-local than quantum mechanics, right? These PR boxes and things like that. So I immediately set to work to try and see what the relevant structures are here. Unfortunately, these theories, they're not actually that quantum-like, to be honest. I don't know what they're going to do. Actually, they can't do a lot of things that quantum mechanics can, and they do other things, so maybe this isn't such a surprise. But they don't have much of the structure that I've dealt with. For example, they don't actually have basis structures. You can show that they can't have that. If you've got a basis structure, it turns out you can ensure that you've got a compact structure, which is what I just talked about here. And if you've got a compact structure, you can do things like teleportation, which you can't do, I think, in those theories. Also, this dagger operation, you don't have this bijection in those theories, right? Because I think in those theories, you can have a much greater range of states that you can prepare, but the effects, which are sort of the dagger of these, are much more limited. The measurements you can do are more limited. So they don't really fall into this sort of paradigm. So my initial hopes for this whole sort of approach were slightly dashed by that. So I no longer think that it's a sort of, you know, you could put every physical theory into this form and then look for its basis structures and look for the phase group and immediately assess whether it was had a local hidden variable theory or not. So I'm not entirely sure what the importance will turn out to be within this categorical approach, but it should give a criterion for assessing quite a few theories, I think, whether they do have a Merlin type argument to rule out in real.
I mean, somewhat related to Pavlov and Lucian's, one of his questions, which is sort of what's the new thing that came out of this? And it seems that one of them might be this dot product that the circle with the dot in the middle.
Yeah.
Has that been identified before, or can you say something? I mean, it seems to play a role technically in your argument, certainly.
Well, yeah, it's the operation.
How should we think of it physically? Is there a way to think of it physically, or do you think it has some wider significance beyond this kind of argument? It seems that for any basis you get it, but you need unbiased states. What's the exact story?
Oh, you don't need unbiased states. I mean, you can just.
Do this for any basis.
Given
any basis, you have.
I mean, all you need.
You have an inner product on two states, two vectors, and not an inner product.
This manual.
Non-wide of another, or whatever you call it.
You can. You can just show that. It's as easy as just.
Like a header.
Here it is.
Oh, is that that? Just, yeah. Oh, it is the Hedemark product, yes. But that just means multiplication of the.
Yeah.
Yes. I see. So.
Yeah,
quick question.
So I wonder if this formalism captures a particular intuition about the difference between the two theories, which is that it's the difference between the nature of the correlations across space and across time. So in the stabilizer theory, if I do, you know, preparations of Z, X, or Y eigenstates, and then I later measure the same basis, right? So if I prepare Z, I measure Z, I'll find always correlation. And similarly, if I prepare an X eigenstate and measure X, always I'll get correlation because it's just an identity operation.
Yeah.
But the only quantum states that give a perfect correlation for X, X, and Y, Y, and Z, Z on two systems always give you, give you correlated outcomes for all three. It's always, you know, an odd number of anticorrelations. So like the singlet, for example, yeah. If I get Z up here, I get Z down there. Yeah. But in the toy theory, you do have a state which gives you perfect correlation across space, which is like the identity. So it seems like the difference in the phase group is telling us something about the relationship between the way temporal and spatial correlations are in the theory. And that seems to correspond to the bending of the wires in some rough way. So I think my question is just, does anything in the formalism suggest to you that interpretation?
I wonder if it's got, when you bend the wires around, you get this lower star appearing, which turns out to be trivial in the case of the toy theory, which I suppose also related to everything self inverse in the Z2 times Z2 case,
mm-hmm.
Whereas you get non trivial inverses for Z4. Sounds a bit like a broken record, but I don't know. I'd have to think about it. Yeah, that's interesting.
Okay. All right, well, let's thank Bill again.